Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It has been an amazing quarter century for astrophysics. In that time, scientists have come to understand how old and how big the universe is, approximately how many galaxies and stars it contains, where new stars come from, and where black holes and dark energy can be found. All those leaps forward share one thing in common. They were studied or revealed using the revolutionary Hubble Space Telescope, a piece of technology first famous for its nearly catastrophic myopia, and then for the enlightening and frankly beautiful images it has sent back ever since a daring space mission to fix a flaw in its original mirror. Mario Livio is senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute, and he is featured in a NOVA documentary, Invisible Universe Revealed, which airs April 22nd on KERA Channel 13 television. Mario, welcome to Think.
My pleasure to be here.
The film says the Hubble Space Telescope may be the most scientifically productive instrument in history. Is that hyperbole, or is it a reasonable statement to make?
You know, I think it's a fairly reasonable statement to make. I mean, if you consider that, almost 13,000 scientific papers have been written based on Hubble data, and that those papers have been cited more than 500,000 times, that gives you an idea of how productive this telescope has been.
What's the relationship between the Space Telescope Institute, Science Institute, where you work, and NASA?
So we are funded by NASA. The Space Telescope Science Institute is managed by an association of universities for research in astronomy. So that is an association of a few dozen leading universities. But the funding for the institute comes from NASA.
The Hubble has confirmed our suspicions that there is great beauty to be found in deep space. I was showing my daughter some images last night, and she just assumed that they were created by an artist. She didn't believe they were real. They were so beautiful.
It's true. I mean, there has been an art critic, actually, in England, who a few years ago wrote that he thought that the Hubble images were the most flamboyant artworks of our time. Mm. The images have been really breathtakingly beautiful, and everybody enjoys them.
Hubble has done such wonderful things over the past 25 years that I think younger people may not even realize it was almost a colossal failure. How did it happen that it was initially launched with a mirror that wasn't ground to the correct specifications, and why was like a single millimeter error such a disaster?
Yeah, well, it was actually much less than a millimeter, but the thing was that that mirror was polished. You know, it was the best polished mirror in the world ever. But like you said, it was done to the wrong specification. It's like somebody giving you these perfect lenses for your glasses, but they are somehow done with the wrong number. So in that particular case, the mirror was slightly flatter than it should have been. And what that caused is, you know, we call this spherical aberration. Basically, it caused the images to be less sharp than we wanted them to be. Had this been a cheaper experiment, maybe people would have cared less. But since this was the most expensive at the time space telescope, clearly, everybody was initially at least very, very disappointed when it was not living up to its expectations. Fortunately, that did not take long to actually fix it.
It just took a lot of creative thinking and then a lot of practice beforehand by the astronauts who went up and made the repair.
That's right. So, it really was showing, how science and astronauts and the space agency and so on and engineers work together, and the ingenuity of all these people and the bravery of the astronauts to make this work. Basically, scientists and engineers came up with a scheme of corrective optics that could be installed inside the telescope that would restore it to the original specifications, a bit like putting glasses on somebody who doesn't see so well. And then since Hubble was originally built to be serviced, well, not to be serviced for this, but to be serviced, that allowed astronauts to go up in the shuttle and in a number of spacewalks to actually install these corrective optics, and the telescope became even better than originally designed.
What do you remember, Mario, about the first perfect image that you saw from the corrected Hubble? Was it an emotional moment?
Oh, it was incredible. Look, I mean, we all believed that the servicing mission could do the job, but nobody really knew, you know, this has never been tried before, that they will actually succeed in doing everything that they were supposed to do. You know, I was sitting there actually all the nights when the servicing was happening and watching it. And there were very scary moments inside all of that. I mean, there was, for example, some silly almost incident where the astronauts couldn't close the doors of the telescope. And, you know, that would have been a disaster. I mean, the telescope could not have worked had that happened. But then, you know, they figured out ways and so on, which only showed, you know, when you have people working on this, they always come up with some very clever solutions. So we were just, you know, so relieved and just enthusiastic when the things turned out to be working fine.
Tell us about the telescope's namesake, Edwin Hubble. How did he figure out distances between objects observed in the night sky before we had this marvelous piece of technology that would be named for him decades later?
So Edwin Hubble decided to use some objects inside galaxies, in particular some type of stars that vary in a regular fashion, which are called Cepheid variables. These are stars that, you know, they go up and they go down periodically like this. And astronomer Henrietta Leavitt discovered that there was some very tight relation between the period at which they go up and down and how bright these stars are. And so what that meant is that if you measure the period, which is relatively easy, I mean, not easy, but relatively easy, then you could tell how bright the stars are. And if you can tell how bright something really is, and then you look at how bright you actually see it, you can determine how distant it is. It's a bit like, you know, if I hold a candle or if I held a bulb of 100 watts at different distances from you, since you know the intrinsic brightness of this bulb, by seeing how much light you get from it, you can determine how far away the bulb is.
So he found out the distance between these objects in the universe, and then the understanding of the nature of the universe changed because it appeared that some of those distances were changing. Things were moving away from each other.
Right. So what Hubble and actually people before him discovered, I mean, it was not the first, Hubble was not the first to actually discover that, but he used results of people before him that showed something that is a little bit like the familiar Doppler effect. You know, like if you have a fire engine, then when it's coming towards you, and it has its siren on, then what happens is that the waves, in that particular case, the waves of sound, they get compressed. So you hear somewhat of a higher pitch. When it's going away from you, the waves get spread out. So you hear a lower pitch. So, for example, when that fire engine passes you by, you hear this sound that goes like, ee-oh. It goes from high pitch to low pitch. Well, something similar happens to light. And so that if something is moving away from you, the light waves, they get more spread out and they are shifted towards the color red. Hence, we call this redshift. So what Edwin Hubble saw was that for almost every distant object he looked at, the light was redshifted, which meant things were moving away from us. And that's how we discovered, basically, that our universe is expanding.
And if we know it's expanding, that suggests that it started with a singularity, or what laymen call the Big Bang.
That's right. Basically, you run that movie backwards, you know, and you can determine when did that expansion start. You know, it's like, you know, if you have an inflating balloon, you run it backwards and you find when did the balloon start expanding.
If we were able to run it backwards that whole way, would we be able to find the precise location where the Big Bang occurred?
Well, there is no location. The Big Bang happened everywhere. Please remember that it's not as if there was a pre-existing space inside which our universe is expanding. Our universe is the space. So it is the entire space that was located in a particular point. It's not that point exists in some pre-existing space. So if you like, the Big Bang happened exactly in the studio in which you're sitting right now.
Mind-blowing stuff. Mario Livio is my guest. He's senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute and featured in the NOVA documentary Invisible Universe Revealed, which airs April 22nd on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13. We will resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by emailing think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes with Mario Livio.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Mario Livio, who is senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute and who is featured in the NOVA documentary Invisible Universe Revealed. You can watch the whole thing April 22nd on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, one more quick explainer, Mario. A lot of people know that the Hubble orbits just a few hundred miles above the Earth. Given the enormity of space, why are the images collected from that distance without an atmosphere so vastly superior to anything that we can see with the great telescopes that we have mounted on the ground?
So basically, it's exactly what you mentioned. It's the fact that Hubble is above most of the Earth's atmosphere. The atmosphere introduces turbulence, which makes the images less sharp. We call this the resolution of the telescope. And also the atmosphere introduces a sort of a glow because of various chemicals in the atmosphere, which make the atmosphere not very dark. And what that does is it doesn't allow you to see very faint objects from the ground. We call this the sensitivity of the telescope. Now, because Hubble is above most of that, it has a better resolution and sensitivity than most other telescopes.
So we have one Hubble telescope and an inconceivably enormous universe to explore. How are decisions made about what the Hubble will photograph?
So every year, we have a call for proposals for, you know, astronomers worldwide that send very detailed proposals of what they intend to observe with Hubble, and very detailed explanations of both why this is important from the perspective of the science and also, you know, exactly how they're going to do the observation, what instruments they're going to use, what filters they're going to use, and how that will exactly contribute to answering the questions that they want to answer. So we get about more than 1,000 proposals every year. In fact, just this past Friday was the deadline for the call for proposals for this year, for this cycle. And then we have a time allocation committee, which acts in stages. There are panels of experts from all over the world in various areas of astronomy and astrophysics, and they basically read all the proposals and rank order them. And then they decide which are the best proposals that will be observed. And, you know, roughly speaking, on the average, maybe only just one out of seven proposals actually gets to be observed.
So one of the things that Hubble confirmed for us is that it appears there is a very large black hole in the center of just about every observable galaxy. What does a black hole look like from the perspective of the Hubble?
So, of course, Hubble cannot see the black hole itself.
Right.
The black hole, by definition, doesn't emit any light, so it cannot be seen. However, the black hole, since it's a relatively large mass concentrated in a very small space, it does have a strong gravity in its vicinity. And by observing either stars at the centers of those galaxies and how they move, or gas at the centers of those galaxies, you can tell that there is a very large concentrated mass there. Basically, you know, just in broad terms, if there is no black hole there, you see the stars at the center moving kind of every which way, while if there is a black hole there, the orbits of the stars are more organized and you can see them moving. So you basically can tell that there is a dark mass at the center there, and those are these black holes.
What spawns those black holes? Does the black hole come first and then a galaxy forms around it?
Well, that's a very famous chicken and egg problem to which we don't exactly know the answer. I mean, it is very possible that, you know, when galaxies form, they form with some, you know, relatively smallish black holes at their center. And then that black hole grows, first of all, by accreting mass, by collecting mass from its surrounding, and also by the fact that galaxies tend to merge. And when they merge, their central black holes merge as well, and thereby increase their mass. It is also possible that the formation of the black hole seeds, in some sense, the formation of the galaxy, so that the fact that the black hole forms there helps the formation of the galaxy around it. What we do know, however, is that the black hole and the galaxy do know about each other, because Hubble has discovered a very tight relation between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the bulge of stars at the center of the galaxy. So it's not as if the black hole and the galaxy evolve independently. They definitely evolve together.
Does anything about the nature of particular black holes explain the variation in shapes of galaxies?
No, there is relatively little connection to shapes of galaxies. We see black holes both in galaxies we call spiral, which are, you know, sort of pancake-shaped, and in galaxies that are elliptical, which are more egg-type shape. It is true that some of the more massive black holes are at centers of more elliptical galaxies, but that may have to do with the way that those galaxies are formed, and, you know, they themselves are the result of mergers of smaller galaxies and so on. But otherwise, there is no strong correlation between the black hole and the shape of the galaxy.
Let's go to the phone now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Livio, I've read your book, Is God a Mathematician, and The Golden Ratio. I really enjoyed those books. I thought that they were extremely
Thank
helpful
you.
Furthering my education. I had a question. You spoke earlier about the problems with the mirror and, I guess, the astronauts that went up to fix that. What were some of the problems that the astronauts encountered, and also what were some of the immediate effects of fixing the mirror? What were some of the greatest accomplishments that followed fixing that mirror?
Thanks for your call.
So First of all, let me just remind you that the astronauts didn't just fix the mirror. I mean, Hubble has been serviced five times already. I mean, the first servicing mission was the one that the main goal of which was to fix the mirror. But since then, we had four other servicing missions where astronauts installed new instruments, repaired old ones, installed new gyroscopes, a new computer, and so on. So astronauts, you know, kept upgrading and repairing Hubble. The fix of the mirror originally was done by introducing some sort of a corrective optics type thing that involved 10 small mirrors that, like I said, were like putting eyeglasses on the telescope. Since then, that has been removed because all other instruments that have since been installed already take into account the correction introduced because of the spherical aberration. So there is no longer need for that particular corrective optics. Without, you know, correcting for the optics of the telescope, we really could not have done all the fantastic science that Hubble has done. In particular, the resolution was nowhere near what we actually have. Hubble has this really incredible resolution of, you know, Hubble can read, well, it doesn't do that, but if it were to do that, it could read the date on a dime from 2 miles away.
Wow. I was surprised to learn in the film, Mario, that it's a real challenge for Hubble to find and photograph supernovae. Why are they so tough to capture?
They are extremely rare. I mean, supernovae are these exploding stars that are very bright, and we see them half across the universe, but they're very rare. I mean, in every galaxy, you know, you have just about one every 100 years or so. You know, in our own galaxy, actually, we have not seen one in more than 300 years. You know, some people say that that's because there hasn't been a great astronomer in the past 300 years. Because there was, in the end of the 16th century, they have seen two within 30 years. So these were Tycho Brahe and Johannes Kepler. So they are rare. And remember, Hubble actually has a very, very tiny field of view. So to find anything with Hubble is really hard. I mean, normally what happens is that you find these things with other telescopes, and then Hubble follows up and observes those objects.
And Hubble's been working really well for 25 years. It's solar powered. How much longer does it have? What's the expectation for the service life of this particular telescope?
So the plan is for Hubble to work for at least five more years till 2020, which will be fantastic because in 2018, we plan to launch the James Webb Space Telescope, the scientific successor of Hubble. So that will allow the two telescopes to overlap for at least 2 years. But really, there is no reason why Hubble couldn't work beyond those 5 years. So, you know, unless something fails in a catastrophic way, as long as Hubble is scientifically productive, I mean, it is very possible that, you know, Hubble could work for another decade.
Do you think, Mario, that it will be like, you know, people who are perfectly happy with an iPhone 5 suddenly, like, can't stand it anymore and want the iPhone 6? Like, do you imagine people bailing from the Hubble project to work on the James Webb?
Well, people are working on the James Webb. You know, my institute is going to run the scientific program of the James Webb as well. And at this point, you know, at least half of our people are working on James Webb, but about half are still working on Hubble. So, you see, they are very different telescopes. Hubble observes primarily invisible light. It's the kind of light that we see, and also in ultraviolet light, while the James Webb Space Telescope is exclusively an infrared telescope. It looks at radiation that's more akin to heat radiation. So the two telescopes are really complementary to each other. They don't you know, do the same things as the other does. So it is very, very interesting to actually observe, in particular, if there is an object, you know, let's say a supernova explosion that happens relatively nearby, it would be great to observe it with both telescopes because then you get a much more complete picture.
We're speaking this hour with Mario Livio, senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute. He's featured in a new NOVA documentary, Invisible Universe Revealed, that you can watch on KERA Channel 13 Television, April 22nd. We'll come back to our conversation in a few minutes. So if you'd like to join us, you can call right now, 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute, Mario Livio. He's featured in an upcoming NOVA documentary called Invisible Universe Revealed that airs April 22nd on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to be part of our conversation about the Hubble, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Mario, how has the Hubble helped us understand the existence of dark matter and dark energy, and have we made a lot of progress in understanding exactly what they are?
So it has definitely helped us a lot in even the discovery of dark energy. We thought for many years that while we knew that our universe is expanding, Edwin Hubble discovered that in the late 1920s, we thought that the expansion should be slowing down because, you know, of the gravity of all the mass within the universe. We thought in the same way that, you know, I throw an object up here on Earth, it slows down because of the Earth's gravity. So we thought that the mass within the universe should slow down the expansion. Instead, what was discovered in 1998 was that the expansion not only is not slowing down, it's speeding up, it's accelerating. It's as if there is something pushing on it to actually accelerate the expansion. And the thing that does the pushing or propels this acceleration is the thing we call dark energy. The way that this was discovered was by observing first from the ground and then also with Hubble, very distant exploding stars called supernova explosions, in particular a particular type called type 1A supernovae, which we know how their light behaves in a very well-calibrated way. And you see, if you look at supernovae that are, let's say, 7 billion light years away, it means that the light that left that exploding star left it 7 billion years ago. So you get a glimpse of the universe, how it was 7 billion years ago. And then by comparing the expansion then and now, we could tell that the expansion is accelerating. And Hubble contributed some of the crucial observations of the most distant objects in that type of scheme. So that was a very important contribution because this discovery of the accelerated expansion, you know, led to a Nobel Prize in physics and led to this thing of dark energy, which is doing this repulsion that appears to be accelerating the universe. Let me first say a few words about dark matter, and then I'll come back to say what do we know about them. So dark matter is something very different. Dark matter is basically matter that we know it's there because we see the gravitational force that it exerts. It keeps galaxies together, clusters of galaxies together, only that it doesn't shine any light. It doesn't shine nor absorb any light. So in terms of that, what Hubble has helped us do is to basically map the distribution of dark matter, to get like, you know, maps of where it is and how does it surround galaxies and clusters of galaxies. That's what we've done with Hubble. In both cases, there are still big mysteries that remain. In the case of dark matter, while we see all the effects, we don't know what are the particles that of which dark matter constitutes of. Our best guesses are that these are some sort of subatomic particles that are yet to be discovered, and maybe the Large Hadron Collider, which started its operation again just a few weeks ago, maybe they will finally discover some of the particles that are candidates to be dark matter. But so far, we have not discovered those particles. In the case of dark energy, that's even more complicated, because that is something that's smoothly distributed through space. And as far as we can tell for now, that's basically the energy associated, believe it or not, with empty space, with the vacuum. The vacuum in physics is not something where there is nothing there. It's very active. There are virtual particles and antiparticles that appear and disappear in fractions of seconds. And we think that that's what dark energy probably is. But we still have not confirmed that, because we don't have yet managed to place meaningful constraints on the properties of this dark energy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have a call from Tom in Mesquite. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Yeah, just a quick question. You know, I'm always amazed at the photographs that come out or the pictures that come out on the Hubble. And, of course, the one that everybody talks about often is the deep field. And I just wondered, I was curious as to who decided or who came up with the idea of doing that particular photograph or that particular view by the Hubble scope. I think that would be interesting to know how that all came about.
So that particular, you know, we have had a few deep fields. I mean, the original deep field was called the Hubble Deep Field. Then we also had the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. We had the Extreme Deep Field and so on. But they're all deep images of the universe. The original Hubble Deep Field was decided upon by the then director of the institute where I work, Bob Williams, after consulting with a committee of experts. And then, so they decided to take as deep an image of the universe as they could, namely to stare at a tiny patch of sky, roughly the size that you would see through a drinking straw, for 10 full days with a telescope. And for that, they chose an area. The area was chosen, the patch was chosen, so that it will be virtually empty. There were no galaxies there, no known stars there, nothing really of any significance there that was known, because, you know, we wanted to see what we would see if we get this very, very deep image. And what we discovered was truly amazing, because in that tiny area of sky, thousands of galaxies, each one having hundreds of billions of stars like the sun, showed up. So that actually gave us a sense for the first time that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies in the observable universe.
Do you find, Mario, that astrophysicists have to be even more flexible in their thinking, more willing to accept new information that turns everything you think you've known on its head than other kinds of scientists?
I'm not sure if it's more than other kinds of sciences, but it is certainly the case that, you know, in astrophysics, you very often you don't get to do the experiment. It's not like when you do an experiment in the lab, which, you know, you actually decide exactly how to do the experiment, and maybe you have done the experiment one way, you'll do it another way, and you are free to change the parameters and so on. We have been given one universe to observe, and we have to observe this one universe. So, of course, we have to take what the universe gives us, And Hubble has certainly been very good in giving us this universe.
Is the art in your office, do you have pictures, images that have come from Hubble?
Yes, there are some images that have come from Hubble, and the Institute is full of images that have come from Hubble. Hubble images have adorned, you know, they've been in art exhibits, even in art museums. They've been on the covers of books. There is a Pearl Jam album that has a Hubble image on its cover. So, yes, Hubble images have appeared in the most unexpected places. They have inspired a piece of music called the Hubble Cantata. They have inspired a piece of ballet by the Dance Exchange Company. So, yes, by now, Hubble images have definitely, you know, crossed over into culture in general and not just science.
Mario Livio is senior astrophysicist at the Hubble Space Telescope Science Institute, and he's featured in the NOVA documentary Invisible Universe Revealed, which airs April 22nd on KERA Channel 13 television. Mario, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. We really appreciate it. Thanks.